in 1945 in Egypt in the Nag Hammadi library, which was buried about 365 AD because the church had become the strong-armed back of the Roman Empire. And there had been an episode of a young Roman emperor who had come in to reinstate the ancient wisdom before the Roman Catholic Church was made the carrier of the Roman Empire. And he lasted just a couple of years, and then he was done away with. And then the counter-revolution came in to persecute those pagans mercilessly, and the Nag Hammadi material was buried to protect it from being confiscated and burnt. And no one came to claim it or check on it, and so from 365 to 1945, it was buried. This is the prayer of thanksgiving that is the culminating prayer for the Hermetic, lost Hermetic treatise, the eighth reveals the ninth. The tape will have the first half of it, and this is the second half. The delight of the man who attains to thee is one thing, that we know thee. We have known thee, O intellectual light, O life of life, we have known thee. O womb of every creature, we have known thee. O womb pregnant with the nature of the Father, we have known thee. O eternal permanence of the begetting Father, thus have we worshipped thy goodness. There is one petition that we ask. We would be preserved in knowledge. And there is one protection we desire, that we not stumble in this kind of life. When they had said these things in prayer, they embraced each other, and they went to eat their holy food, which has no blood in it. The origin of this is in the Platonic dialogue, the Symposium. The Symposium means the discussion at the banquet. Sometimes the dialogue is called the banquet. When Percy Shelley translated the Greek into English as a precocious young man of about 20, he called it the banquet, Plato's dialogue, the banquet. And it is there at the banquet where the discussion is about love and all of the false, sophistic, parading understandings of love are finally put to rest by Socrates, who says, this is a wisdom I inherited from Diotima of Mantinea, who received it through the originating community, that community of Pythagoras. The use of a banquet to give thanks carries on still today, coming up with Thanksgiving. The way in which a thanksgiving like this came into Judaism is through the teacher of righteousness. The teacher of righteousness, always called that, has a document in another group of discovered writings, also found in 1945, but found at the site of Qumran on the Dead Sea in Israel. the Dead Sea Scrolls. And among the Dead Sea Scrolls preserved are more than 30 Thanksgiving hymns by the Teacher of Righteousness, and their Jewish name as a collection is the Hodiot. The Teacher of Righteousness is one of the world's greatest writers, unrecognized because there is not yet a presentation of high wisdom that discloses this. In my book on Jesus and Alexandria and Mary Magdalene, we'll do this. The Teacher of Righteousness was born in Alexandria about 220 BC, at a time when the great library of Alexandria had for the first time not only included the Jewish scriptures, the Torah and the prophets, into a translation in Greek called the Septuagint, which means the 70. There were actually 72 translators, six from each of the 12 tribes, brought by Ptolemy Philadelphus, the second Ptolemy to Alexandria, housed on Pharos Island, and allowed to translate out of the Hebrew into the Greek in such a way that the Greek translation of the Torah and the prophets became the Bible for more Jews than the Hebrew. The Jewish population of Alexandria in the time of Jesus was nearly a million people. The city itself had about 2 million people. It was one of the largest cities in the world. Only Rome would have been comparable in enormous size. The way in which the Teacher of Righteousness was able to refine himself was to write three books of the three just men, Noah, Job, and Daniel. So that when we look at the Bible, the book of Job is also, I submit, by the Teacher of Righteousness. It is based upon the dialogue interplay between Job and three detractors who wish to point out to him, you must have done something to deserve what has happened to you. God is not unjust. And its structure is based on the structure which the archetypal Greek tragedy is based. The book of Noah has almost disappeared, but fragments have been recovered, and I expect in the next decade or so it will be able to be reconstructed enough. And the book of Daniel is extremely important because it is the great exemplar of being able to look back in retrospect. Much like the book of Job looks back in retrospect because there is an original seed of the story of Job some 1,800 years before, at the very beginnings of the alphabetic language made in what became Phoenicia. The book of Noah, of course, is retrospective. And so these books are retrospective into the past in order to introduce into the present moment for the Teacher of Righteousness. His writing began about the high 190s and extended to about 160 BC. The book of Daniel was brought back to Alexandria by the Teacher of Righteousness near the end of his life. And in fact, the main street that goes from the Mediterranean Sea to Lake Mareotis That street, even today, is still called Nebi Daniel. And Nebi Daniel crosses the great boulevard of the east and west, the Sun Gate and the Moon Gate. And those major streets of Alexandria make a mandala out of the city. They divide it into quarters, four quarters. And each of them was wide enough to have 10 chariots wide, which meant that they were almost 100 feet wide, and they were paved in marble. And along both of those main boulevards, all of the buildings were made out of white marble with colonnades, Greek architecture, so that it was said it is possible on a moonlit night to read scrolls openly in Alexandria just from the light of the moon on these major streets, a city that never sleeps. The Great White Way was there in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. Two white ways. Today in Alexandria, there are two mosques facing each other on either side of the Nebi Daniel, the street of the prophet Daniel. One of those mosques is on the side of the street where the great library of Alexandria was extended. It was extended after a great fire occurred at the time of Julius Caesar, where his ships were being attacked, and in order to save them, he torched them so that they couldn't be used to blockade the harbor against him. And they caught some of the warehouses on fire, and they burnt some of the great library. And in order to pay back to Cleopatra, he confiscated the great library of Pergamum and donated that entire library to Cleopatra. And they extended the great library. And it was extended up almost to the point where the two great boulevards came together. And on one side of that, in the extension, is where the Teacher of Righteousness spent his last years. On the other side of that boulevard was the great Sema, the temple of the body of Alexander the Great, and all of the Ptolemaic kings were buried in that building, the Sema. And next door to the Sema is where the richest family in Alexandria lived, and they were Jews. And they had a last name, Alexander, because they were brought originally to Alexandria when it was first founded by Alexander the Great himself. And so they were allowed to have his name as their family name. And later, because they were great benefactors of Julius Caesar, saving his life, saving literally the whole relationality, so they were able to take the middle name Julius. And so all the males are named something Julius Alexander. Julius Caesar's first name was Gaius. One of the most famous members of that family was Philo of Alexandria, whose full name would have been Philo Julius Alexander, whose brother was the richest man in Alexandria, and his name was Gaius Julius Alexander. The family owned the shipping trade routes to India that went from Alexandria down the canal to the Rosetta branch of the Nile, down the Nile, all the way down to Koptos, and then over land, a caravan of about 4 or 5 days to Myos Hormos, and then on the Red Sea, and then down the coast, down to Ethiopia, which at that time, the kingdom of Ethiopia was actually a Sheba kingdom from the ancient Queen of Sheba, which extended over the narrow waterway to Saudi Arabia, which was Sabah, and still today called Sabah, it's in Yemen. where all the trade routes of Arabia brought frankincense and myrrh, and the Ethiopian side of that brought the gold from Africa, plus ivory, apes, exotic things. And it was the springboard to go across the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean, because there are monsoon winds that come up once a year and they blow for about 30 days. And instead of having to go along the shoreline of South Arabia and what is today Iran and Pakistan to get to the Indus, you could go directly across in just a few days. And where it took you was South India. And so South India had the Jewish trading colonies that brought the spices from India all the way back through and picking up more cargo of getting the incenses from Arabia and the gold and animals and ivory from Africa and bringing them up to Myos Hormos overland by huge caravans loaded onto large Nile boat fleets and taken to Alexandria and from there dispensed and dispersed throughout the world. The trading routes from the Mediterranean all the way to Britain and to the Atlantic coast of Africa and to the Spanish coast were owned by a consortium of Jews, and there were three men who owned that long trading route. One of them was Joseph of Arimathea. His business partner in Jerusalem was Nicodemus. You can read about him in the Gospel according to John. And the third was named Simon, and he ran the port home on the Phoenician coast in Tyre. But Simon came down with leprosy. And so he had to move the family home, which was not in Tyre, but was on the coast of the Sea of Galilee at Magdala. The family home had to be relocated, and they relocated it in Bethany, on the far side of the Mount of Olives, because the leper colony was on the far side. Mount of Olives had a lot of cemeteries and burial places, and a valley ravine incline where the lepers could be. And so that family house was run by one of the daughters of Simon the leper. The oldest daughter's name was Martha. But the oldest child was a man who was in charge of the family business connections at Tyre. His name was Lazarus. And his full name is Lazarus Bar Simon. Just like Peter's real name is Simon Bar-Jonah. His father's name was Jonah. The youngest child, the youngest daughter, was Mary Magdalene. She was put under the aegis of Lazarus Bar-Simon in Tyre, which is why her education was very special. Usually women were not educated. She, because of the family connections, they were international traders for thousands of miles. She learned many languages. She learned to write beautifully because she was a talented artist. She could write Greek, Syriac, and Hebrew equally well and make a kind of a poetry in any one of those three languages that could be translated into any other two of those languages and still carry the poetic as a real talent. And of course, she spoke Latin and Aramaic and a number of other languages as well. Extremely refined. One of the connections between Tyre and Alexandria and Jerusalem is in the New Testament. When John the Baptist is beheaded, his followers buried him, and then immediately came and told Jesus. It's at that time that Jesus goes off in the wilderness to meditate. And so many people followed him, there were 5,000 people. And he had them sit in groups of 50s and fed them with just 5 loaves, a couple of fish. Then after that, he went to Tyre. Why would he go to Tyre? To make arrangements to have the body of John the Baptist taken away from where it had been hastily put into the ground and sent to Alexandria for safekeeping by the trade routes, because they overlapped there. Lazarus was a very close friend to Philo of Alexandria. It was Lazarus who brought Mary Magdalene first to Alexandria when she was about 17 and met Jesus for the first time. And this would have been about 9 AD. And they were together in the greater Alexandria area for about 30-some years together. So she knew him better and closer than anyone else in his life. The peculiar thing is that this entire entourage of significance was shunted aside massively in order to keep the founding of the Roman Catholic Church, the original founding. Because the Alexandrian experience, after the crucifixion and the resurrection, as we've been talking about, was spread out because of these long trade routes between the Bay of Bengal and the Irish Sea. It was possible within a year's time to send apostles and Holy Family members to the ends of the world. The Bay of Bengal and the Irish Sea at that time were outside of the Roman Empire. They were safe. We've talked about how the Holy Family largely went to the site of Glastonbury, and how Thomas went to the sites of southern India and then went north and came across a king. This is a Gondopheres was his name, and this is a coin that's in the Pakistani Museum today in Lahore. And you can see the moon-like peaked hood of King Gondopheres and the lantern light and the beginnings of a staff, and you can find this in the tarot deck. It is the hermit card. And you will see in the light of the hermit card, especially in the Waite, Pamela Coleman Smith deck, the hermetic star is the light of that lantern. Gondopheres found that Thomas was an architect, extremely renowned and recommended. And I've talked about that story before, and how Gondopheres gave him a huge fortune to build a temple for him, and he gave all the money away. And when he was seized for fraud, St. Thomas said, "I have built you a temple that will last forever. It is built by the best architecture that there is." Gondopheres was able to pass on the insight so that the next great king that came in not only got his kingdom in what was then called Gandhara, today it's Pakistan, but included a great deal of Central Asia as well through Kabul and over the Hindu Kush. And that king's name was Kanishka. And Kanishka is the one who spread the Mahayana through this figure, Ashvaghosha, into Central Asia. And that's how the Mahayana expanded not only into Afghanistan through the Bamiyan Valley, but into Central Asia, from there into China, into Tibet, into Japan. And the Mahayana means literally the great way. And it is literally the way of Jesus in its expansion. And the Mahayana is distinguished, as we have shown, by the appearance of this book. This is a translation done by the young D.T. Suzuki, published in Chicago in 1900, Ashvaghosha's Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. The faith is the key to the awakening. And what happens when one is awakened by faith, there is a way in which that is matured into wisdom. Hence, the wisdom literature of the Bible is the third level from the Torah, the prophets, and the wisdom literature. It's the highest energy level because it has extra dimensions to it. The extra dimension to the Theravada, the way of the elders of the original Buddha, becomes transformed into the Mahayana, the great way. And the third level of the Mahayana is the refinement to the Vajrayana, the diamond way. What is being presented here in this series is a further refinement of the way, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana. It's the Parayana. It's the way beyond. Not only to make the diamond person by the vision of the great way from the substantiality of the way, but the way beyond, because we are now going into a new refinement of species. We are going into a species that is best described as Homo sapiens stellaris, star wisdom man. The star is the Hermetic star. One of the interesting things is that in the Hermetica, and they're now thankfully called the Hermetica, this is a edition that Brian Copenhaver, who was the provost at UCLA when I knew him, put out. At the end of most of the significant treatises that make up the Hermetica, there is a concluding hymn. The way in which they're arranged, the Hermetica, has been distorted. The first time that an English edition of trying to present all of the Hermetica together was in four volumes, this is a reprint of the first, was done by a very famous writer of English novels, Sir Walter Scott, who lived from 1771 to 1832, and he devoted his entire life to the Hermetica and commentaries on them, and they're still in print. The rearrangement of the Hermetica into not just the set of 13 or the set of 23, but into the original set of 14 is something that I have put back together a couple of years ago when I put out a new edition of my presentation of the Hermetica. The second and third of the Scott Hermetica are very short and they belong together, and their original title was The Sacred Sermon. I have added the eighth reveals the ninth in its place so that we are able to work it in, and I have added the Asclepius at the end to make a series of 14. By the time of Clement of Alexandria, about 175-180 AD, there were 42 books of the Hermetica, and the 42 is 3 times 14, so that the original Hermetica is a set of 14. Then there were 2 other sets of 14, making a total of 42 by the time of Clement of Alexandria. In order to make sure that the tradition was pure and was able to be carried back, the founder of a new kind of a school in Alexandria is called the Catechetical School. The man who founded it was named Panteus, and his first prize student was Clement of Alexandria. he needed to have the foundation pivot in order to establish the catechetical school accurately. But he knew that he could not trust the translations, which by that time already had gone through many filters of editing and manipulation. So in order to found the school, he knew he had to have the beginning of what was not the Torah, but the Testament. So the New Testament is an expansion of the Torah by extra dimensions. But in order to secure an untampered with Gospel of Matthew, he had to journey all the way to India. And he found a copy, because when Thomas went to India, he took with him the only gospel that was written at that time, which was Matthew. Thomas went to India in 40 AD. So Matthew wrote his gospel about 39 AD. And Pantaeus brought back the original gospel of Matthew. And when you look at the beginning of Matthew, you see Matthew is an honorific name given to him by Jesus. His real name was Levi, and his father's name was Alphaeus. And so his name was actually Levi bar Alphaeus, but Jesus gave him the name Matthew. It means literally honored of God. And at the beginning, if you look at the Gospel of Matthew, he lays out the generations of Jesus, which means the time forms by generations. And the first time form is 14 generations from Abraham to David, 1,000 years. The second time form is from David to the coming back from the exile, 14 generations. And the third is coming back from the exile to Jesus, 14 generations, altogether 42. So that you get a tripartite structure of three 14s making a 42. So that the Hermetica are actually a way of calibrating time by the way in which Matthew set the archetype for how time can be calibrated when one understands all of its dimensions. When one is given, over a three-year period, the instruction of the best teacher of time forms that there is, the Lord of History. This way is how one computes in an analytic and aesthetic way what one can come to prove out symbolically and translate back into the ritual pragmatos by the transforms of the artistic prismatic. And if the prismatic and the pragmatic are able to be brought together, they form together a tandem that's like the double cube of the music room. It's like the seven-part set of notes and the eight-part set of notes, where you understand that there's an invisible overlap. There's one that is hidden there. Like in the Kabbalah, Das is hidden. There are 10 sephiroth, but there's one that is hidden. All of this is a way of proofing out for oneself that the analytic is able to be understood and carried down through its levels, from the calculus to the trigonometric, to the geometric, by either number or music. And to be able then to visualize that in such a way that what occurs is the ninth dimension of the complementarity. And in the eighth reveals the ninth. What is said clearly is that from the ninth dimension, one can hear a singing from the 10th dimension, from the perfect dimension. One, for the first time, hears the choir of the angels in heaven, and what they are doing is they are singing songs of praise continuously through eternity. And one is able, for the first time, to hear the sound within sound because the silence within silence complements it in such a way in a ninth dimension that the tenth dimension form is a hyperspace. And that hyperspace has a hyper-resonant effect. The effect is that a 11-dimensional field of fertile zero occurs in such a way that phenomenality is spontaneously able to come out of it not just once, but any number of times with exact frequency so that every element has its own frequency, every molecule has its own frequency, that there is literally a sound for everything. Not only phenomenally there, but possible throughout all time. And one can learn to hear in such a way that you can sing along with it. And that singing along with it is what happens after the banquet in these hymns. This is an Aeon hymn from the Hermetica, just a few lines. God, Aeon, Cosmos, Time, coming to be. God makes the Aeon. The Aeon makes the cosmos. The cosmos makes time. And time makes coming to be. The essence of God is the good. The essence of the Aeon is sameness. The essence of the cosmos is order. The essence of time is change. And the essence of coming to be is life. More next week. Yeah.